Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the African American community. This week, the African American Hour is recognizing Black History Month with stories about five Afro-Americans. We'll hear stories from the British Broadcasting Corporation about Paul Robeson. There's a book review about Queen Mother Moore from The Atlantic magazine. I'll be reading New York Times newspaper obituaries for mathematician Gladys West and former Black Panther H. Rapp Brown. And I'm starting with this obituary titled, U.S. Civil Rights Pioneer Claudette Colvin, Dead at 86. This was written by Steve Gorman and published January 13, 2026, at the website Reuters.com. U.S. Civil Rights Pioneer Claudette Colvin, arrested at age 15 for refusing to give up her bus seat to a white woman in Montgomery, Alabama, 9 months before Rosa Parks' similar but more famous act of defiance, died on Tuesday, January 13th, at age 86. Although she remained a largely unsung figure in the civil rights movement for decades, Colvin's 1955 act of rebellion inspired Parks and others and helped form the basis for the federal lawsuit that outlawed racial segregation in U.S. public transportation. Her death, under hospice care in Texas, was confirmed by Ashley Roseborough, a spokesperson for her family and the Claudette Colvin Foundation. In one of the first publicized acts of civil disobedience against Montgomery's Jim Crow rules governing city bus seating by race, Colvin refused to relinquish her seat for a white woman, as ordered by the driver, and stayed put until she was dragged off the bus by police. According to accounts of her testimony in court, Colvin recalled she had been studying anti-slavery abolition heroes in school and felt that she had Harriet Tubman on one shoulder and Sojourner Truth on the other, and history had me glued to the seat. But Parks, an older seamstress who was secretary of the local NAACP chapter, was seen as a more dignified, sympathetic figure to rally behind as civil rights leaders organized what became the year-long bus boycott that thrust the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to the national stage. In the lead-up to the boycott, which started in December 1955, issues of social class and even colorism, Colvin came from a poorer background, led civil rights leaders to shy away from the teenager as a standard-bearer for the movement, according to Roseborough. About a year after her arrest, she also became pregnant by a married man from an encounter that she later described as statutory rape. Nevertheless, Colvin went on to become one of several plaintiffs and a principal witness in the Browder v. Gale lawsuit challenging the city's Jim Crow bus policies. The case eventually led to the landmark 1956 United States Supreme Court decision banning segregation in public transit as unconstitutional. Colvin lived in obscurity for decades afterward, working as a caregiver and nurse's aide and struggling as a single mother, though historians and others have since brought to light the pivotal role she played in the early civil rights movement. Fred Gray, the attorney behind Browder v. Gale, credited Colvin with helping to ignite the battle against segregation in the Deep South. "I don't mean to take any away from Mrs. Parks, but Claudette gave all of us the moral courage to do what we did," the Washington Post quoted Gray as saying. In recent years, Colvin succeeded in having her juvenile arrest record expunged, Roseborough said. That was the Reuters news agency story titled, U.S. Civil Rights Pioneer Claudette Colvin Dead at 86. It was written by Steve Gorman and published January 13, 2026 at the website Reuters.com. My next reading is titled, How the 1950s Red Scare Erased a U.S. Icon. This was written by Matt Glazebrook and published January 16, 2026 at the British Broadcasting Corporation's BBC.com website. Paul Robeson was a superstar of the stage and screen, a talented football player and a music hitmaker. Then, amid the anti-communist fervor of the U.S. in the Cold War, came a dramatic fall from grace. Paul Robeson's Ballad for Americans was an unlikely pop smash. A 10-minute-long patriotic folk cantata, it offered an inclusive version of the U.S. story, from fiery formation, in 1776 the sky was red, to a pan-ethnic present, as articulated by a narrator who reveals himself to be America itself. Yet, when the celebrated baritone first performed the song on a national CBS radio broadcast in 1939, it became an instant sensation. The studio audience cheered for 20 minutes. Letters and phone calls flooded into the station and the show was repeated throughout the following year. Already a star of stage, screen, and the football field, the broadcast and subsequent single release of Ballad for Americans cemented Robeson's status as the most famous black person in America. A mere decade later, however, he had been branded not just un-American, but an effective non-person, barred from television, expunged from textbooks, his passport revoked. As the Cold War took hold and the U.S. political and cultural establishment was gripped by anti-communist fervor, Robeson's civil rights activism and socialist solidarity made him a prime target. He died January 23, 1976, 200 years after the bloody birth of the U.S. and 50 years ago this month. His final decades were marked by illness and seclusion, the lingering effects of a campaign of suppression that was unprecedented, even amid the widespread entertainment industry blacklisting that characterized the Red Scare. Paul Robeson was born in 1898 in Princeton, New Jersey, the youngest of five children. His father, a pastor, raised the family after his mother died in a house fire a few years after his birth. To say that Robeson was a remarkable young man would be a significant understatement. He excelled academically in sports and the arts while attending his New Jersey high school. He won a four-year scholarship to Rutgers University, eventually leaving with the highest academic honors and delivering the graduating class oration. He was awarded 15 varsity letters, including for baseball, basketball, javelin, discus, and shot put. But it was at American football that he became a true star, twice making the All-American first team before playing professionally to help finance his studies at Columbia Law School in the early 1920s. Walter Camp, the United States' leading football expert, called Robeson the greatest defensive back ever to trot the gridiron. Living in Harlem at the height of the Harlem Renaissance, Robeson also used his time at Columbia to take up acting, as well as singing at the famous Cotton Club. His legal career ended abruptly not long after graduation, when he quit his position at a law firm in protest after a white secretary refused to take dictation from him. Instead, he became a full-time performer, supported financially by his first wife, Eslanda, the head of New York Presbyterian Hospital's pathology laboratory. He starred in two Eugene O'Neill plays, All God's Children Got Wings and Emperor Jones. Recorded albums of so-called Negro spirituals and opened a new Oscar Hammerstein and Jerome Kern musical, Showboat, in 1927, singing Old Man River to critical acclaim. He also began traveling to the United Kingdom and Europe. In 1930, he played Othello at London's Savoy Theatre, the first black actor to do so in the British capital since Ira Ulrich a century before. And when, after spending much of the early decade performing overseas, he returned to the United States to star in the 1936 Hollywood film version of Showboat, his ascension to A-list status was complete. In 1928, New Yorker magazine had labeled him the promise of his race, king of Harlem, and the idol of his people. By 1940, shortly after he performed Ballad for Americans for 30,000 people at the Hollywood Bowl, Collier's magazine crowned him America's number one Negro entertainer, according to his biographer Martin Duberman. Robeson seemed to the white world in general a magnetic, civilized, and gifted man who had relied on talent rather than belligerence to rise above his circumstances. In reality, Robeson spent much of his rise to fame educating himself and becoming increasingly outspoken on the broader context of the black struggle. In Europe, he performed benefits for Welsh miners, Jewish refugees, and Republican fighters in the Spanish Civil War. He studied African languages and Marxist writings and visited the Soviet Union. Back home in the United States, he refused to perform for segregated audiences, joined union picket lines, and in the 1948 presidential race, campaigned for Henry Wallace's Progressive Party. Yet all these causes proved relatively undamaging to Robeson prior to a speech he gave in Paris on April 20, 1949. The World Congress of Partisans for Peace was a gathering of some 2,000 scientists, teachers, activists, and artists from 75 countries, convened to condemn the Cold War arms race and what it saw as U.S. aggression against the Soviet Union. It is unthinkable that American Negroes would go to war on behalf of those who have oppressed us for generations, Robeson announced to the assembled leftists. Against a country, the USSR, which in one generation has raised our people to the full dignity of mankind. Some 6 years before the Montgomery bus boycott and the birth of the modern civil rights movement, Robeson suggested a form of black rebellion that far outstripped the assimilationist goals of the then-dominated National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The response from mainstream liberals and conservative anti-communists alike was swift and damning. A few months after Paris, Paul Robeson twice attempted to perform a concert for holidaymakers at Jewish socialist summer camps near Peekskill, New York, just as he had done in previous summers. Twice, thousands of local war veterans counter-protested and rioters attacked concert-goers with rocks, sticks, and fists, overturning cars and injuring 150 people while the police watched on. While this violent attempted cancellation of Robeson was broadly condemned and never repeated, a more subtle version began almost immediately afterwards. In March 1950, NBC barred him from appearing on Eleanor Roosevelt's TV show, Today with Mrs. Roosevelt, after protests by the American Legion, a veterans organization, and others. Then in July, the State Department revoked his passport, preventing him from performing overseas, where he remained hugely popular. In the U.S., his career was effectively already over. Record companies refused to issue his old records or record new ones. From being on the top 10 highest paid performers in the U.S. in 1941 and earning $100,000 from concerts as late as 1947, by 1952, he was barely making $6,000 a year. The lyrics of Ballad for Americans were removed from school textbooks, and the poet Langston Hughes was forced to cut any mention of Robeson from his book Famous Negro Music Makers, lest it be banned from school library shelves. His name was retrospectively erased from lists of NAACP award winners and football champions alike. Even owning a Paul Robeson record, as hundreds of thousands of Americans had done, was enough to earn government employees a black mark at the various loyalty board interviews that took place in the 1950s. Baseball star Jackie Robinson was brought before the House Committee on Un-American Activities to disassociate himself, and by extension, the black public, from Robeson's Paris remarks. Eventually in 1956, Robeson himself appeared before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. Unapologetic as ever, he told the committee members, "You are the un-Americans." In her book, Many Are the Crimes, Cold War historian Ellen Schrecker argues that probably no other individual was as heavily censored as Paul Robeson. And in some ways, he did present a unique threat, not as a spy, but as an outspoken black socialist, someone who linked the African-American fight for civil rights to the cause of the working classes worldwide, from the Welsh Valleys to West Africa, from Mississippi to Moscow. And of all those blacklisted, from Hollywood screenwriters to civil servants and academics, none were as high profile or once beloved. As Schrecker says, the most charismatic black actor and singer of his generation had become a non-person. Robeson's passport was finally returned to him in 1959, and he tried to once again tour internationally. But worn down from his years of struggle, his efforts were derailed by bouts of sickness and depression. By the mid-1960s, he ceased giving concerts entirely, and following the death of Eslanda, spent his remaining years under the care of his sister. In 1973, he addressed a Salute to Paul Robeson event at New York's Carnegie Hall. He declared himself dedicated as ever for the worldwide cause of humanity for freedom, peace, and brotherhood, affirmed his commitment to the struggle of African Americans to achieve complete liberation from racist domination, and paid tribute to anti-colonial movements around the world. He concluded his message with the following: "Though ill health has compelled my retirement, you can be sure that in my heart I go on singing. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And old man River, he just keeps rolling along." That was the article, "How the 1950s Red Scare Erased a U.S. Icon." This was written by Matt Glazebrook and published January 16, 2026 at the British Broadcasting Corporation's BBC.com website. My next reading is a book review, and is about Queen Mother Moore. The title is The Midwife of Black Nationalism. This was written by Dara T. Mathis and published December 16, 2025 in The Atlantic Magazine. The subtitle to the review is A New Biography of Audley Moore Shows How Pivotal the Overlooked Activist's Work Was to 20th Century Black Liberation Efforts. Midway through William Greaves' documentary, Nation Time, which follows the 1972 National Black Political Convention, a woman named Audley Moore stands in a busy hallway preaching to people's backs. She is clad in a burgundy and navy floral caftan and matching head wrap. Her voice rings out amid the bustling crowd of convention goers. "Now let me tell you, Benjamin Franklin said, those who seek temporary security rather than basic liberty deserve neither. I'm demanding reparations. That's all I can see now. That's the answer for our people." She is paraphrasing Franklin's quote, one whose meaning is frequently misconstrued, but the invocation of the Founding Father lends both heft and irony to her calls for redress from the American government. Moore catches a few passers-by and jokes with them, shoving a typewritten paper in their hands as they walk away. A few stay to listen. The scene aptly encapsulates the life of Audley Queen Mother Moore, an often overlooked black nationalist organizer who fought vociferously for black self-determination until her death in 1997. A laudable new biography, Queen Mother, Black Nationalism, Reparations, and the Untold Story of Audley Moore, by the historian Ashley D. Farmer, uses Moore's story to chart a trajectory of black nationalist activism in the United States. From Garveyism in the 1920s, Moore belonged to the New Orleans chapter of Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, or UNIA, to the 1995 Million Man March for Black Male Unity and Self-Empowerment. Moore's radical ideas, including her desire for a separate black nation in the South, earned her ridicule at times, but her sharp critiques of American white supremacy also found purchase, influencing activists such as Malcolm X, Muhammad Ahmad, and Charles J. Ogletree, Jr. Despite her prolific political organizing and wide reach during her lifetime, Moore has largely been omitted from the history of civil rights activism. Her exclusion from traditional archives is a familiar story to scholars of black American life, especially those who study the contribution of women. Farmer writes that her book, which she spent a decade researching and writing, required painstaking effort to locate traces of more in personal papers, land deeds, files from the FBI and the House Un-American Activities Committee, all history tapes and lingering memories, much of Moore's ephemera, were lost in a house fire. The resulting work, which examines her involvement in a striking diverse roster of organizations, is a portrait of a woman with uncanny savvy and flexibility. Moore worked with nationalists, communists, moderate liberals, white and black alike. Whatever it took to pursue goals such as fair housing regulations, just labor laws, and equitable resource distribution, she was sometimes self-contradicting as an activist, which isn't to say she wasn't singularly dedicated to her cause. She seems to have simply understood that achieving her objectives in all their multiplicity required maximal fluidity. Activists with unchanging missions might be easier to pin down, and thus less likely to be forgotten. But Moore's story shows that the Black nationalist movement also encompassed people who were willing to find areas of compromise in order to get the job done. Moore was born in 1898 in New Iberia, Louisiana, to a well-off family that descended from both enslaved and free Black communities. But both her parents died before she reached adulthood, and she was forced to turn to domestic work in white households, one of the few economic avenues available to her at the time. In the violent, segregated South during World War I, Moore looked on as America made its grand debut on the world stage as a great emancipator, a masterful public performance as liberty's beacon shining from the West, all while extending white supremacy's tendrils across the globe, Farmer writes. Having noticed that the Army didn't offer as much support for Black soldiers as it did for white ones, Moore and her two sisters provided meals and recreation space to these troops in Anniston, Alabama. Losing the protection of Black elite society that her parents had afforded her, and witnessing the contradiction between America's actions abroad and at home, helped shape Moore's lifelong advocacy for civil rights and for working class concerns. It is difficult to overstate the influence on Moore's development of Marcus Garvey, the foremost Black nationalist of the 20th century. Garvey sought to revitalize Africa for the Africans and to repatriate people of African descent to their motherland. He also championed Black pride, self-reliance, and racial separatism on the basis that white people would never recognize Black people's human rights. His teaching showed the fledgling activist how to analyze Black people's social conditions and gave her the desire to unify Black people everywhere. In 1922, Moore joined the UNIA in New Orleans, attending meetings and studying the history of the global African diaspora. She and her then husband once even packed up all their possessions, planning to expatriate to Liberia as part of one of Garvey's Back to Africa initiatives, before ultimately deciding to stay in the United States. After Garvey was deported in 1927 following a mail fraud conviction, Moore was forced to channel her activism into vehicles beyond the declining UNIA. A move to Harlem brought her into the orbit of the Communist Party. A card-carrying member by 1936, Moore cut her teeth protesting racist and sexist discrimination across New York City, forming tenants' rights organizations and sending aid to Ethiopia after a 1935 invasion by Italy. In response to Black communist demands that the party address both class and race oppression, communist leaders had come to believe that Black people constituted an oppressed nation and that it was within the party's interest to fight for their rights. But Moore's association with the communists was less an ideological commitment, Farmer writes, than a practical way to work towards Garvey's anti-imperialist, pro-Black goals. Collaborating with the moderate National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Moore advocated for the freedom of five of the Scottsboro Boys, a group of nine Black teens falsely accused of raping two white women in Alabama. Moore also worked on many causes tangential to Black nationalism, including lowering the price of milk for children and boycotting goods from Nazi Germany. Among her other strange bedfellows, Farmer mentions Mary McLeod Bethune's respectable middle-class National Council of Negro Women, an unlikely place for a black nationalist and communist who was primarily self-educated. But more success in organizing with communists had taught her that, as Farmer writes, an organization need not be explicitly black nationalist in its mission to advance the cause. The cause itself, for more, and truthfully for many black nationalists, couldn't be distilled into a clear unified goal. As James Edward Smethurst, a scholar of 20th century black radical movements, writes in his book, The Black Arts Movement, the actual definition and tactics of black nationalism were secondary to the belief that, without self-determination, black people would be oppressed and exploited second-class or non-citizens in the United States. Moore's activism exemplifies how, as Smethurst writes, old left and old nationalist spaces often intersected with each other and with those of the new left, the civil rights movement, and the new nationalists, particularly Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam, in surprising ways. In 1950, Moore fell out with the Communist Party because of its shifting focus away from black equality. Over the next two decades, her politics would harden. She mentored many young black nationalists, including Malcolm X and Ahmad, the founder of the Revolutionary Action Movement. But as Farmer writes, guiding all of Moore's work was a single overreaching dream, rooted in her early days with the UNIA, gaining reparations. In 1962, Moore launched a campaign to persuade the United States government to pay reparations to descendants of enslaved Africans, which she timed for the centennial of the Emancipation Proclamation the following year. She and her fellow activists charged that the country owed black Americans $500 trillion, to be paid in land and cash distributed to individuals annually. She even sought the formation of a separatist black nation in the United States, what she called a national territory in a country developed by our blood and tears and unrequited slave labor. This was groundbreaking at a time when the zeitgeist prioritized inclusion in the American body politic rather than separation and redress. In the 1960s, Moore would become known by the honorific Queen Mother Moore, in recognition of her role as an elder stateswoman to black organizers across the political spectrum. During a trip to Ghana in 1972, she was crowned with the title in an Asante ceremony. In the 70s, she reached the height of her influence in the Black Power movement, becoming a mentor figure to a Detroit-based separatist group, the Republic of New Africa, that advocated for five Black Belt states to be given to black Americans as a nation state. In spite of the group's unrealized dreams, as well as struggles with surveillance and violent disruption from the FBI's counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO, Farmer writes that Moore still affirmed at the end of the 70s, "I'm a hard nationalist." In Queen Mother, Farmer takes a clear-eyed look at Moore's foibles, noting her absenteeism during her son's formative years, her embrace of patriarchal hierarchy in black communities, and her exhortations for black women to embrace polygamy to facilitate nation building. Farmer acknowledges that black nationalism sometimes took violent action, claiming the right to govern themselves and to defend themselves. But she also seeks to correct a common misunderstanding of the ideology, arguing that it's not the violent, incoherent, and nihilistic inverse of the civil rights movement, but a campaign with the very same goals, sought through different means, separation from white society rather than integration. Still, many of Moore's ideas were on the fringe then, Farmer writes, as they are now. The historian doesn't explain away Moore's infatuation and personal association with Ugandan dictator Idi Amin, who in 1975 invited her to attend a meeting of the Organization of African Unity in Kampala, Uganda. As Farmer writes, Moore was thrilled by him and seemed to ignore the fact that his rule had become known for its corruption and human rights abuses. But Farmer doesn't need to justify all of Moore's beliefs and goals to make a case for her influence. Her meticulous study of the many figures, movements, and organizations Moore worked with shows that her contributions were pivotal rather than peripheral. Moore was a Garveyite through line, what Farmer calls a midwife, to many 20th century black nationalist activists, a lot of them men who remain more famous than her. Queen Mother establishes her as a titan in her own right, a central influence in nearly a century of global black liberation struggles, and a reminder for modern activists of a persistent truth, that cooperation does not have to mean compromising one's values, and that those who dream of freedom have more than one way of achieving it. That was a review of the book, Queen Mother, Black Nationalism, Reparations, and the Untold Story of Audley Moore, written by Ashley Farmer. The title of the review is The Midwife of Black Nationalism, written by Dara T. Mathis and published December 16, 2025 in The Atlantic Magazine. My next reading is an obituary. There is language in this obituary that will be offensive to some listeners. Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, black power activist known as H. Rap Brown, dies at 82. This was written by Paul Battello and published November 23, 2025 in the New York Times newspaper. Jameel Abdullah Al-Amin, who as H. Rap Brown defined black militancy in the 1960s with a call to arms against white oppression, and who later lived quietly as a Muslim cleric and shopkeeper until his arrest in 2000 in the murder of a sheriff's deputy, died on Sunday, November 23rd in a federal prison hospital in North Carolina. He was 82. His death at the Federal Medical Center Butner was confirmed by Christy Brashears, the Director of Communications for the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which operates the hospital. She did not specify a cause. In February, the Washington Informer newspaper reported that Mr. Al-Amin had multiple myeloma and that his health was deteriorating. He had been serving a life sentence without parole. Before converting to Islam and changing his name in the 1970s, Mr. Al-Amin was one of the most incendiary orators among the black power activists who emerged in the late 1960s to challenge the leadership and nonviolent strategy of the civil rights movement. An admirer of the Cuban Revolution, he preached armed resistance and separatism, declaring, "Violence is necessary. Violence is a part of America's culture. It is as American as cherry pie." With his trademark black beret and sunglasses, dexterous mind, and imposing 6-foot-5-inch frame, 7 feet with his afro, he was a persuasive and charismatic figure to many, adept at rallying black audiences to his cause while alarming many white listeners. Elected chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in May 1967, he made an immediate mark by getting the word nonviolent removed from its name, persuading the organization's leaders to change it to the Student National Coordinating Committee. That summer, as riots erupted in black neighborhoods in more than 100 American cities, Mr. Al-Amin made himself known to a wider audience through speeches that gave voice to black anger and righteous indignation over a century of unfulfilled expectations since the end of slavery. "Black folk built America, and if it don't come around, we're gonna burn America down," he would say. A call to arms he delivered hundreds of times from 1967 to 1969 on street corners and college campuses and in meeting halls across the country. "You've got to arm yourself," he said. "If you're going to loot, loot yourself a gun store." After 5 days of rioting in Detroit that left 43 people dead and some 2,000 buildings destroyed in July 1967, Mr. Al-Amin declared that violence would be the new language of race relations. "I don't think you could articulate the sentiments of black people any better than they just did in Detroit," he said. The rhetoric gave him a high profile in the news media, made him the target of FBI surveillance, and led to his repeated arrest on gun-related arson and conspiracy charges. His actions also helped ensure passage in 1968 of the first law in the nation's history to make it illegal to incite, organize, promote, or encourage a riot. Conservatives in Congress attached the provision to the landmark 1968 Fair Housing Law as a condition of their support. Though they were reacting to riots in Detroit, Newark, and the Watts section of Los Angeles, in which Mr. Alamein had played no known role, they called the measure the H. Rapp Brown Federal Anti-Riot Act. Mr. Alamein told reporters who sought his reaction, "We don't control anybody. The black people are rebelling. You don't organize rebellions." The next part of the obituary is titled, "Wanted by the FBI." Enmeshed in court proceedings resulting from federal and state charges he faced in five cities, Mr. Alamein went into hiding in 1970 and spent 18 months on the FBI's most wanted list. He resurfaced in Manhattan on October 16th in 1971, in dramatic fashion, wounded in a shootout with the New York City police. The police said he and several accomplices had tried to hold up an uptown Manhattan tavern and exchange gunfire with officers who were pursuing them. Mr. Brown, who denied the charges, was convicted on charges of robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. He served 5 years of a 5 to 15 year sentence at the Attica State Prison in upstate New York. At the time he was released on parole in 1976, he had converted to the Muslim Sunni sect known as Darul Islam. By his account, he had become a new man with a new name. He moved to Atlanta, where his wife Karima had established a law practice, and publicly renounced the revolutionary ambitions of his youth. Mr. Alamein founded a mosque called the Community Masjid, opened a small general store selling groceries, incense, and Qurans, and for the next quarter century was known to his neighbors as a local businessman and spiritual leader. He and his wife of 57 years, Karima Alamein, had two sons, Kairi and Ali Alamein, all of whom survive him. In Atlanta's West End, where he lived, Mr. Alamein organized summer youth games and led efforts to curb street crime and drug trafficking. The head of an Islamic civic group in Atlanta called him a pillar of the Muslim community. Law enforcement authorities came to view him differently. Beginning shortly after the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, local and federal authorities began a series of investigations into Mr. Alamein's activities, according to police files uncovered by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper in 2000. Quoting from FBI documents and local law enforcement officials, the newspaper said that the FBI had sent paid informants to infiltrate Mr. Alamein's mosque and helped local police investigate possible links between Mr. Alamein and a variety of criminal activities, including terrorist plots, a gun-running syndicate, a series of Atlanta bank robberies, an explosives-making ring, and 14 murders in the city between 1990 and 1996. No links were found, the newspaper said. In 1995, a neighborhood resident who was shot near his store named Mr. Alamein as the assailant, but later recanted, saying the police had pressured him into making a false accusation. He said he did not really know who shot him. Mr. Alamein's lawyer said at the time that the police were looking for any excuse to put Mr. Alamein in jail. But he remained out of jail and relatively out of the public eye until March 2000. His reemergence, like his resurfacing in 1971, was announced by a hail of gunfire exchanged with the police. The next part of the obituary is titled, "A Deputy Sheriff Dead." While approaching Mr. Alamein's store on the night of March 16th to serve Mr. Alamein with an arrest warrant for missing a court appearance on a minor traffic case, the Fulton County, Georgia Deputy Sheriff Richard Kinchin and his partner, Algernon English, were both shot by a heavily armed man standing on the street outside. In an ensuing shootout, Mr. Kinchin was fatally shot in the abdomen. Mr. English was struck by 4 bullets but survived. That night, in a hospital, Mr. English identified Mr. Alamein as the assailant through a photograph and told investigators that he was pretty sure he had shot the man. His account was supported by a trail of blood leading from the spot where the gunman had stood. Mr. Alamein was arrested 4 days later at a friend's home in rural Alabama. He showed no sign of a gunshot wound or injury to explain the blood at the scene, as his lawyers later pointed out at his murder trial. The police and prosecutors later said that the blood had proved to be a false lead, unrelated to the March 16th shootings. Mr. Al-Amin denied being the gunman and characterized his arrest as the latest in a series of secret government efforts to frame him. The FBI has a file on me containing 44,000 documents, he told the New York Times in 2002, speaking from a payphone at the Fulton County Jail on the eve of the trial. At some point, they had to make something happen to justify all the investigations and all the money they've spent. More than anything else, he added, they still fear a personality, a character coming up among African Americans who could galvanize support among all the different elements of the African American community. A jury, 9 of whose members were black, convicted him after a 3-week trial. The chief witness against him was Mr. English, who testified that on the night of the shootings, he and his partner approached Mr. Al-Amin on the street, told him they had a warrant, and asked him to show his hands. He said, yeah, frowned, and swung up an assault rifle and started shooting, Mr. English said in court. In a death penalty hearing, a parade of witnesses testified on Mr. Al-Amin's behalf, asking that his life be spared. One was Andrew Young, the former mayor of Atlanta and ambassador to the United Nations, who said that Mr. Al-Amin had helped reduce crime and improve conditions for many people in the city's impoverished West End. The next section of the obituary is titled, Louisiana Born. Hubert Gerald Brown, Rap was a nickname from his youth, was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on October 4, 1943, the youngest of 3 children of Eddie and Thelma Brown. His father, who was serving in the Army when Hubert was born, worked for the Standard Oil Company for 30 years. His mother worked 2 jobs, as a domestic and as a teacher at an orphanage for black children, and was partial toward Hubert because I was lighter, he wrote in his 1969 autobiography, Die, Nigger, Die. Light-skinned black people, he wrote, were considered more likely to gain a foothold in white society, according to the hierarchy of skin color observed by his mother and her generation in the early 20th century South. Because I was lighter, it meant that I was supposed to get ahead, he wrote, adding that the favor she showed him created tension between him and his 2 siblings, especially his older brother Ed. Ed and I are very close now, and that color thing doesn't come between us anymore, he wrote. But it's a thing that could really damage the black community if people don't begin to understand it. Black is not a color, but the way you think. After graduating from a private school affiliated with Southern University, a historically black institution in Baton Rouge, his mother insisted that all her children attended. Mr. Al-Amin spent 2 years at Southern, then left for Washington to work in the civil rights movement with his brother, Ed Brown. A student at Howard University who had become active in organizing lunch counter sit-ins for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Mr. Al-Amin participated in voter registration drives in Mississippi and Alabama and in rural Lowndes County, Alabama, where only a handful of black citizens were registered to vote, even though 85% of its population was black. He became friendly with Stokely Carmichael, later known as Kwame Ture, who was a veteran of the early 1960s freedom rides and one of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's Rising Stars. In 1965, when Mr. Al-Amin was named head of the Washington, D.C. chapter of SNCC, he joined a faction led by Mr. Carmichael. And, calling itself the Young Turks, it urged the organization to take a more aggressive posture, outmaneuvering moderate leaders like the SNCC chairman, John Lewis, the future Georgia congressman, and Julian Bond, who went on to become a Georgia state senator. The militant faction elected Mr. Carmichael chairman in 1966. Mr. Carmichael made the first of his many black power speeches shortly afterward, warning that until black people achieved the necessary economic, political, and firearm power, as was their right under the Second Amendment, there would never be racial harmony in America. By the time Mr. Al-Amin succeeded Mr. Carmichael as chairman in 1967, SNCC had adopted a black separatist agenda, a policy barring white people from leadership roles and the stated goal of achieving freedom. In the words of Malcolm X, the nationalist leader assassinated in 1965, by any means necessary. The beginning of Mr. Alamein's tenure coincided with the urban riots that swept the country in what became known as the long hot summer of 1967. Mr. Alamein visited Cincinnati in June to show support for the young black man who had rioted for three nights running, then gave a speech the next day to several hundred youths in Dayton that the Dayton police said incited a window-breaking rampage covering 12 square blocks. On July 24th, after addressing a crowd of several thousand at a rally in Cambridge, Massachusetts, "If Cambridge doesn't come around, burn it down," he told them. Mr. Alamein suffered a superficial gunshot wound in the forehead when the police fired their weapons to disperse the crowd, setting off a riot there too. The next section of the obituary is titled, "Under Surveillance." In memos later made public, the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover ordered his agents to begin arresting Mr. Alamein and other SNCC leaders on every possible charge until they could no longer make bail. Informants were dispatched to infiltrate SNCC and other groups referred to by Hoover as nationalist hate-type organizations to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize them. Mr. Alamein continued to hopscotch the country as indictments, subpoenas, and extradition orders began raining down. He was under surveillance around the clock, but the pressure did not change his rhetoric. "If President Johnson is worried about my rifle," he told reporters after being released on bail from federal weapons charges in New York in 1967, "wait until I get my atom bomb." Mr. Alamein's brother, Ed, who had become president and chief executive of the Southern Agriculture Corporation, a nonprofit organization helping black farmers obtain federal subsidies and other benefits historically denied them, died in 2011. Mr. Alamein twice appealed his murder conviction in 2004 and 2019 and was denied each time. But as recently as 2020, his supporters had sought a new trial on the grounds that exculpatory evidence, including a prison inmate's confession to having shot deputies Kinchin and English, was withheld from his defense lawyers. From the time of his arrival in federal Supermax prison in Colorado, Mr. Alamein was held for long periods in solitary confinement, which his family members contended was a violation of constitutional protections against cruel and unusual punishment. In a 1995 interview with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper, Mr. Alamein said he was forever being asked about his famous aphorism about violence being as American as cherry pie. He said the remark referred to the sweep of American history, beginning with the Revolutionary War and continuing through slavery, the subjugation of Native Americans, foreign wars, and civil strife. "People ask me if I didn't mean apple pie," he added. "No, George Washington and cherry pie." That was the obituary titled "Jameel Abdullah Alamein, Black Power Activist Known as H. Rap Brown, Dies at 82. It was written by Paul Vitello and published November 23, 2025 in the New York Times newspaper. Next, an obituary titled "Gladys West, Unsung Figure in Development of GPS, Dies at 95. This was written by Michael Rosenwald and published January 27, 2026. The subtitle is, "As a Navy mathematician in the 1950s and beyond, she played an unheralded but foundational role in making possible the global satellite-based mapping system." Gladys West, a mathematician at the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory whose modeling of the Earth's shape played a critical role in the development of GPS, the global satellite mapping system that pilots, firefighters, and drivers use to get where they're going, died on January 17th in Fredericksburg, Virginia. She was 95. Dr. West lived with her daughter, Carolyn West Oglesby, and died at her home. Born to black farmers in rural Virginia, Dr. West lived through remarkable societal and technological transformations, from segregation to the civil rights movement, from calculators to supercomputers, and from paper maps to Google Maps. Through it all, she worked in near obscurity. She was almost 90 before she received any recognition of her work. Dr. West's mathematics really did lay the foundation for the global positioning system to be built, D. Sarah Stamps, a geophysicist at Virginia Tech, said in an interview. She made the world more precise for all of us. Dr. West joined the Navy's weapons facility in Dahlgren, Virginia in 1956, a year after President Dwight D. Eisenhower issued an executive order banning racial discrimination in federal workplaces. As one of four black employees at the site, along the lower Potomac River about 50 miles south of Washington, her first job entailed using a hand calculator to verify the accuracy of bombing tables. When you are one of the first to get an opportunity like I was given, you are a trailblazer for all who follow you, Dr. West wrote in her autobiography, It Began with a Dream, published in 2020. You must prove that you not only can carry out your responsibilities satisfactorily, but go beyond what is expected and perform at a high level. She advanced quickly. In the early 1960s, she was part of a team that programmed a computer to run 5 billion calculations in tracking the motion of Pluto relative to Neptune, seeking to better understand planetary orbits. After that, she led a group of mathematicians using an IBM 7030, known as Stretch, one of the most powerful computers of its time, to calculate the precise shape of Earth, accounting for gravitational variations, tidal forces, and the curvature of oceans. Government scientists developing GPS in the early 1970s then incorporated those calculations into the mathematical framework of the still widely used World Geodetic System, which enables GPS satellites to pinpoint precise locations on the planet's surface. We don't realize that when we use our cell phones or a more sophisticated GPS receiver, that the orbit being calculated reflects all of that knowledge, Branford Parkinson, the Air Force colonel who led the development of GPS, said in an interview. The better that knowledge is, the better we know where satellites are, the better we know where we are. Dr. West wasn't acknowledged by scientific organizations for her role in developing GPS. She remained a hidden figure. Even after the 2016 movie Hidden Figures, based on a best-selling nonfiction book of the same title, celebrated the role of black women in the NASA space program. Then, almost by accident, her story surfaced. In 2018, Dr. West attended an event for her college sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha, and mentioned on a biographical form that she had helped with the invention of GPS. Gwen James, a fellow alumna who had known Dr. West for years, was floored. I had absolutely no idea about any of it, she said in an interview. I thought, here was another hidden figure. After the event, Miss James offered to help Dr. West get her story publicized. Do you think anybody would care, she replied. Miss James contacted Dr. West's daughter, telling her she thought it was important that her mother's story finally be told. What story? Her daughter said. It turned out that Dr. West had never even spoken about her job to her children. For one thing, the work was classified. Even as GPS devices emerged in the early 1990s, she was of the generation of women who didn't brag about their careers, however interesting they might have been. They just went along and did their work, Miss James said. They didn't expect anything in return. Miss James contacted a reporter for the Freelance Star in Fredericksburg to share Dr. West's story. The newspaper's subsequent article generated attention from around the world. Then came the honors. In 2018, Dr. West received the Air Force's Space and Missile Pioneers Award. 3 years later, she was the first woman to be awarded the Prince Philip Medal by the Royal Academy of Engineering in London. The National Center of Women's Innovations created a traveling museum exhibit detailing her life. I didn't brag about what I was working on, Dr. West told The Guardian in 2020. But to see other people so excited about it, That was amazing. Gladys May Brown was born on October 27, 1930, in Sutherland, Virginia, a town of sharecroppers about 30 miles south of Richmond. Her parents, Nolan and Macy Scott Brown, owned a tobacco farm. Gladys was one of four children. Growing up, she walked 3 miles to and from a segregated school. In the evenings and on sweltering weekends, she helped harvest tobacco on the farm. At school, she excelled at geometry. I was starting to realize early that this newly found love for geometry was something that could help me find that road I had dreamed about, the road that would take me far away from that farm, she wrote. Gladys was her high school class valedictorian and won a full academic scholarship to Virginia State College, now University, a historically black school in Petersburg. She received a bachelor's degree in 1952 and a master's degree in 1955, both in mathematics. While teaching high school in Martinsville, a city near the Southern Virginia border, Dr. West applied for a job at the naval base at Dahlgren. After reviewing her academic records and recommendation letters, officials invited her for an interview. She turned it down, fearing she might be rejected when they saw she was black. A few weeks later, she received a letter saying that she had been hired anyway. My only thought was, if they were offering me a job in the United States government based solely on my qualifications, this must be God's plan for me, Dr. West wrote. After retiring in 1998, she went back to college, earning a doctorate from Virginia Tech in public administration in 2000. She married Ira West, one of the four black mathematicians at Dahlgren, in 1957. He died in 2024. In addition to her daughter, Dr. West is survived by two sons, David and Michael, seven grandchildren, and eight great-grandchildren. Even after GPS devices became ubiquitous, Dr. West still preferred paper maps. I'm a doer, hands-on kind of person, she told The Guardian. If I can see the road and see where it turns and see where it went, I am more sure. That was the obituary titled, Gladys West, Unsung Figure in Development of GPS, Dies at 95. It was written by Michael Rosenwald and published January 27, 2026 in the New York Times newspaper. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.